Hello and welcome to the Sweep Podcast with me, Mitchell Willis, and him, Michael Holt.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Very, very happy.
You sound over the moon.
I am enthused for a Tuesday. Absolutely. What about yourself?
Yes, also enthused. We've got a whole host ahead of us in the next hour or so. And yeah, it's a cracking weekend overall. How about yours?
Yeah, it was a bit of a weird one, really, because, well, we'll get on to that, shall we, a little bit later on. But, I mean, footballing-wise, it definitely could have been worse Saturday, and then things just took a turn for the better on Monday morning.
Absolutely. And, you know, over the next hour, we have got a footballing feast. Sunday's day of derbies, a managerial sacking, finally, and more triumphs in the Championship, which I'm obviously over the moon about. And then we've also had another visit to Guiseley as we continue the road to the FA Cup. But we do have to start with that derby day, and there's no more anticipated a derby as the North London derby. And this one did not disappoint
it
one bit.
Did not, you are right. Yes, 4-2 to the Arsenal, and what a game it was. It had pretty much everything, didn't it? It had goals, controversy, and another superb performance from the Gunners. Imagine how good they would be if they started playing in the first half and not just the second.
I think they'll take it, though, won't they? They'll take not only this win, but I think it's nearly 20 now they've gone unbeaten. So they're obviously doing something right. And, you know, having taken the lead, got their tails up in this one, and then got pegged back with two pretty quick goals from Spurs. It's the character they showed after that that you have to admire more than anything. And I think, you know, we have to look at one of those Spurs goals. Eric Dier had a lovely time, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He's one of those players who, in an England shirt, you absolutely love him. But as soon as he pulls that Tottenham shirt on, as an opposition fan, you just hate him. He's one of the most insightful footballers going. You just know that the minute anything happens, he's going to be there because he's just a mean man.
Just followed up by Dele Alli as well. Just two proper little shithouse footballers, aren't they? But that said, a little bit of passion is fine, especially in a derby. I don't think it was necessarily the right time or kind of position to put himself in. But, you know, they've gone behind. They've scored two goals eventually, and they're well in the game. And I think from there, you worry about Arsenal. But like you said, they come out the second half, and they have got something about them that they seem to just flick a switch and turn it on. And as soon as Aubameyang grabbed his second of the game, there's only one winner. And from there, they just blew them away. It was relentless, really. And I think, you know, to look at the quality they've got on the bench, the likes of Ramsey, Lacazette coming off, and just changing the game somewhat. And, you know, we said last week, having top strikers for them is huge because they can create chances out of nothing sometimes. And Aubameyang and Lacazette, you know, do you play them together, do you not, is probably an argument we'll always have. But ultimately, when they are on the pitch, generally one of them's going to do something.
Yeah, and I think you look at the depth that they've got in that position, Arsenal. It's something that they've struggled for in years past. And I think probably since Thierry Henry, Robin Van Persie, that's kind of where the list stopped. I know when Adebayor came in, he did well at Arsenal as well. But
Nicholas Bent, no.
Yeah, right, yeah, let's not go back there. I think that Arsenal have probably struggled really to ever have a figurehead up front in probably 5-6 years, something like that. And that will be incredibly pleasing for Arsenal fans. They'll be over the moon that they've got not one but two goal scorers who can do it, and who can do it in different ways as well. They both showed how good they can be on Sunday, and I think Lacazette's goal was well taken. It was probably a little bit fortunate given the deflection and also where it went in from. Lloris would probably look to do a little bit better with that one. But you can't really argue with the chances that they created in the second half, and just how much they were able to go toe-to-toe with the Tottenham side that just looked so much better than them towards the end of the first half.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And obviously Spurs off the back of the win at Chelsea, the win at home to Chelsea last week. And, you know, you've got Arsenal who, they very much took the game to them. You know, they were setting the tempo, no more so than Lucas Torreira, who has been getting better as the season's gone on. He's adapting to the game very well, and he was superb in this. And obviously topped it off with a goal as well, which I don't think anyone necessarily expects from him. But he's clearly got that in the locker as well. And I think just giving them another dimension, it's that player they've just been crying out for 5 or 6 years now. And he's come in and as I say, he's just adapted to the English game and fits in perfectly now. And I think they probably started to build the side around him now. He's almost the first name on the team sheet, and they build that side around him. And, you know, ultimately, for Arsenal now, they have to just continue to push on. And it makes you wonder where they go. You know, they've lost the first two games of the season against Chelsea and Manchester City. Potentially they play them 10 games in and it's a different story. It's not. It's too late to say that now. But they've got the potential now to go on a decent run, to have some good results over the festive period and get themselves, I don't know, knocking on the door of the top two.
I think the problem with Arsenal is the fact that defensively they do still look a little bit awry, and they've got players in those positions who aren't playing week in, week out. I think that we talked about 4 or 5 weeks ago, Arsenal strung together a few clean sheets and it was looking really promising at that point. The worry will be against Bournemouth last weekend, against Tottenham again, and against teams in the Europa League as well. They've not looked fantastic defensively, and they've certainly probably not been challenged in those European games, which then maybe sets them up for a fall when it comes to the weekend, because naturally they probably just get a little bit overconfident. I think that Rob Holding's been good in patches for them, but I still think that they're missing a really aggressive centre-half. I know that Socrates came in this game and again looked okay, but the mistakes in that Arsenal backline are probably at the moment what is separating them from the likes of Liverpool, Chelsea and Manchester City, and the fourth place trophy that they're probably only going to be able to attain this season.
And Spurs, you know, said they beat Chelsea last week. Very, very impressive. And they didn't play too bad in this one, to be honest. They were absolutely blown away by Arsenal. But again, it's just that, it's that patchy nature of Spurs, isn't it? And you hope that that doesn't detract from any good work they do this season, because they've certainly got a good enough start in 11. They've got a decent enough squad as well, and on paper, probably slightly better than Arsenal's as well. But they won't want to see something like this hinder anything as they go forward in the season.
No, and I think if you look back over the last two games that Tottenham have had in the league, you look at Chelsea at home and Arsenal away, would Pochettino have been happy with 3 points? I think he probably would have been. I think on another day you could draw two of those games and actually come out feeling worse about things than you do by losing one of them. So it's a strange position to be in, and we are entering a period of time in the Premier League where the games will come thick and fast. They've got a game on Wednesday at home to Southampton, which is probably the perfect fixture given that they're coming off the back of this defeat. The only worrying thing for Pochettino is the lack of consistency in his defence. You look at how they built on the solid foundations of having Davinson Sanchez and Alderweireld at the back early on in the season, and now neither of those players are playing in this game on Sunday. Wanfoyth looked horrendous again, but he does tend to have one good game and one poor game. So on that basis, with Vertonghen missing on Wednesday, he'll probably be partnered by Alderweireld at the back, and they will look to build again on what has been a relatively good season defensively for them. And all in all, I think that Tottenham have done incredibly well up to this point. They were always unlikely to hang on to the coattails of the top three, and they've done well to be where they are at the moment. But Pochettino just needs to ensure that that squad is galvanised ahead of what could be a massive January transfer window, because you'd imagine that funds aren't going to be overly available for them given the amount of money that they've had to put into the stadium.
Stadium that's not even done yet, with still no real insight as to when that's going to happen.
Well, supposedly fans are going to be invited to go round there towards the end of December, and there are going to be tours open to fans so that they can go in and see what progress has been made. But ultimately, until you can play football there, I don't think that any Tottenham fans really going to be too concerned about going in and having a look. It's become a little bit farcical now. You look at what we've talked about with the World Cup and whether the stadiums were going to be ready in Russia in time, and there's a lot in the press at the moment about what's happening in Qatar, and you can't really look too far from what's happening in North London at the moment, because it's something that you don't expect from the Premier League. You just consider that these things will be completed on time, and even West Ham managed to pull their finger out in the move from the Olympic Stadium. So Tottenham will be concerned about that, but all the time they're picking up points on the field, it will be less of a worry for Pochettino.
On to another huge derby now. Liverpool 1, Everton 0. Do we get into the goal first, or do we save it and build it up a bit?
I think it needs some build-up, especially given the circumstances behind the winner. Let's go from the start, and I think Everton deserve a bit of credit.
Yeah, they do. I thought they were brilliant. Such a cruel defeat for them. They went for it as well. You know, they played possibly the more adventurous game away from home against Liverpool, who, you know, generally build on the attacking prowess that they've got, and they just couldn't find that breakthrough. I thought both keepers as well throughout the game, with the exception of the very end, were in very good form, and two saves in particular stood out. There was the point-blank range save from Andre Gomes from Alisson, which was brilliant, and obviously the follow-up afterwards as well from, was it Joe Gomes on the line?
I think so, yeah.
And then Pickford's save from Shaqiri was unbelievable. I thought, you know, one-on-one with the keeper, he's made a movement to make Shaqiri's mind up for him to have another touch and go with the second shot, thinking he's going to go down. And he's not done that, and he's stood up, made the save, and I just think he's, I mean, that's what Pickford's all about, and he's superb in that position, but obviously then potentially has a ricket in his locker as well.
I think that Pickford's a very forward-thinking goalkeeper. He's somebody who tries to almost take the game to a new level in the way that he distributes the ball, the way that he tries to make players' minds up, not only in a one-on-one situation, but you've seen how good his penalty-saving record's been, and that's because not only does he do his research, but he then tries to get in the head of the person taking the penalty. And a lot of times, you see a goalkeeper, they will stand on the line, they'll jump up and down, they'll wave their arms. But ultimately, if a penalty taker knows where they're going, that's not really going to affect them. I think that Jordan Pickford tries to bring in a different psychological element when he's trying to save these shots and these penalties. And it's really interesting. I agree with you about the ricket. I still think that that's part of his game, but you look at what he was doing at Sunderland, and he was probably committing more of these errors there, yet was still their outstanding player when they lost their Premier League status. So he's going to learn from these mistakes, and we have to remember he's still incredibly young for a goalkeeper. What is he, 23, something yeah. like that? And he will become, in my opinion, England's number one for a huge amount of time going forward. There just doesn't seem to be anyone else around at the moment who's likely to challenge him.
No, I agree. And, you know, Everton, as I said, were brilliant. Gomes, again, was fantastic. It's another solid performance from him. And I think, again, he's just making Everton tick now, and he's really settled in. You've got Bernard, who, for me, is one of the best first touches in the league. His control is absolutely incredible. He's so talented. And then Ademola Lookman came on for about half an hour as well, looked very bright, and hopefully we'll see a bit more of him as the games pile up over the festive period, because he's obviously gone over to Germany and done it, and he's come back in, and Everton wanted to keep him, and you want to see him play a lot more because he's obviously got a lot of potential and a lot of talent.
And that's the thing, I think he will only improve by starting games of football. You saw how useful he was when he went over to Germany, and that's because he was given a run of games, and it was something that he hadn't had previously over in England, and probably up until when he was playing for Charlton. And the frustrating thing from his point of view is the fact that he's gone back to Everton and they wouldn't sell him in the summer, and you thought that there was a reason behind that, and Silva's not really given him as many chances as you would have thought. Now that Richarlison's playing more central, you would imagine that that would open up a position for him to go in there, and if he's able to interchange between Walcott, Bernard and Lookman, then Everton will have one of the most pacey attacks in the Premier League.
Yeah, they will. Speaking of Richarlison, no goal again, which means it's 4-2 to us in the charity bet with listener Eddie Lee.
It was cold though, wasn't it?
It was bloody freezing this weekend, so maybe we are right. Maybe Richarlison just does not like a cold day. Jordan Pickford, we've just spoken about him, and I think it's only right that we talk about the very latter stages of this game. What on earth was he thinking?
I think that's the problem. I'm not sure he was. I think there was a couple of seconds there, and you look at when Virgil van Dijk hits the half volley from the edge of the area, he turns away in disgust because he's convinced that either Pickford's going to catch it or it's going to go over the bar. And I wonder whether other players switching off around him just made Pickford have that lapse. It was quite clear what he had to do. All he needed to do was go up with one arm, tip it over the bar, and I honestly think that it goes out for a corner and the referee blows for full time, because at that point I think we were over the allotted stoppage time anyway.
Do you know what I think? I think that he also thought, where has Divock Origi been? And surely this, I'm not actually seeing this right. What? I honestly couldn't believe when Origi came on. I had no idea he was still there.
I think Klopp was just looking for something different. Liverpool struggled really to get out of second or third gear in this game, and I think the fact that the majority of their chances fell to Shaqiri probably shows you where his thinking was coming. And fair play to Origi. I mean, he's been on the bench pretty much all season. He was farmed out on loan last year. He didn't do brilliantly over in Germany, and he's come back and I think he's been in the cold again. There's talks of him getting a move in January. I know Crystal Palace are possibly interested in him, and it was hilarious when he scored, because he seemed to have the mindset that Liverpool had just equalised. He grabbed the ball and tried to run to the centre circle, and all the players around him just wanted to celebrate. So it was bizarre all round, but I think Pickford shouldn't have tried to catch it. He should have tipped it over, and like I say, I think the final whistle would have gone, and he will hold his hands up. He knows that he made a mistake there. But Everton shouldn't be too disheartened by this, because Liverpool have scored freely at home and away this season, and they've pushed them all the way and probably deserved something on another day. So I think that Pickford will get over it quickly. They've got a home game, I think, against Newcastle midweek, and that will give him a chance to keep a clean sheet and build up the confidence that he's shown so far.
So we say Origi wasn't really celebrating too much. Do you think Jurgen Klopp was?
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's been charged now by the FA, and I think he's accepted that charge, hasn't he? Now,
rightly so.
Yeah, we don't know what's going to come of that, whether he'll receive any ban or whether it'll just be a hefty fine or what, but you have to draw the line somewhere, and it's one thing to sort of go prancing down the touchline in front of the fans. Ronald Koeman did it when he was at Southampton, and I think in that moment you don't mind it too much because you're not on the pitch. It's a case of celebrating. We've seen Klopp jump into the stands before, haven't we, behind the dugouts, but I just thought he probably took it a little bit too far this time.
I agree. He's a character, he's Klopp, and you know, you can love him or hate him. I'm not sure there is too much of a middle ground there. And I think obviously, you know, you can make your mind up as to what we think about it. But yeah, it's not what you want to see. And, you know, ultimately, hopefully, there's some sort of punishment that sets a precedent to stop something like that from happening again, because it starts with one thing and then ends up being another thing. And, you know, I think we were saying last night, if that was Mourinho, who isn't so much of a media darling, there'd be absolute uproar and he'd probably get a 3-game ban.
And that's the issue. It's the different treatment for different managers, and obviously we don't know how that's going to come out yet because we don't know what the punishment will be. But I think Klopp's held his hands up. I think he realised that he screwed up and probably shouldn't have done it. And David Wagner said when he went to Huddersfield, I think he was charged for an incident against Leeds United when they were in the Championship. And I can't remember, was Gary Monk the manager there at the time? They had a little bit of fisticuffs, and he said, listen, in Germany, the passion spills over a lot. We do celebrate with the fans a lot. We do like to add that element to the game, and it's just not something that we're necessarily used to in England. And we saw that when Mourinho did it first time when he was Porto manager at Old Trafford, and everyone kind of thought, who's this guy? What's he doing? And I don't know whether we'll see it more in the game or not, but I think at this stage, people knew that it was the wrong thing to do. He's held his hands up, and hopefully we won't see it again. By all means, jump into the crowd behind the dugouts because it's quite amusing, but coming on the pitch is akin to somebody invading the pitch, and that's where you have to wonder what could have come of it if the Everton fans had reacted maybe in the way... Sorry, not the Everton fans. The Everton substitutes had reacted in the way that the Arsenal substitutes reacted when Eric Dier went over and celebrated in front of their fans. But I thought Marco Silva handled the situation well, and he said that Klopp apologised to him after the game, so fair enough, but I'm not convinced that we need to see a celebration like that again.
I agree, and I don't think we'll be seeing it from Maurizio Sarri anytime soon, where his Chelsea side beat Fulham 2-0, and two goals at either end of the game sealed it for Chelsea in this one. Relatively comfortable game for them. And, you know, they probably deserved a little more, if anything, against the bottom side in the league, and Fulham didn't really offer too much. Pedro with the opener, doing what he does, really. He gets into those positions, and generally he's quite clinical, and I think he's quite underrated, really. He doesn't really get the credit that he deserves because he does score quite a lot of goals.
And I think that's the issue with the inflated squad that they've got at Chelsea, is that there are so many players that can play in his position that you struggle to get a run of games in that side. You think of someone like Cesc Fabregas, who's not getting a look in at the moment for Chelsea, and he is one of the most cultured midfielders that the Premier League's probably ever seen. And the fact that he can't get a game there, he's only 31, and you would imagine that he's probably got another couple of years at the top. He's got an eye for a pass, and we've seen so many times him and Pedro link up in both their Barcelona and their Chelsea days. And it's just a shame, really, that we can't see more of these players in the Premier League. And you look at someone like Loftus-Cheek, who obviously came on and settled the game in the second half. You would want to see more of him as well, because he's got such a great first touch. He's got a real eye for goal, like you said about Pedro. And Chelsea have just got an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the amount of midfielders and attackers that they've got in that club.
Yeah, it's an interesting one with Loftus-Cheek. He's obviously grabbed another goal, and he's starting to play a little bit more football now, and much like Luckman, really, it's going to be interesting to see whether he plays over that festive period a little bit more, whether the rotation comes into play. And obviously, once he gets his opportunity, if he keeps scoring, if he keeps producing on the pitch, then he has to be pushing for a regular starting place. And, you know, we talk about Fabregas not being able to get in there. What does Loftus-Cheek do? Does he stick around after playing a bit of football in December, or does he try and move in January?
I think he'll stick around now. I think if you're going to go out on loan, then you go out on loan for the full season. I don't think that going out in January is particularly going to help his cause. He made the decision in the summer that he wanted to stay and fight for his place, and he's done okay when he's come in. Obviously, he had the hat-trick in the Europa League, and he's shown flashes of what he's able to do. But the issue is, unless you're consistently playing football, then you're not going to progress as a footballer. You make the argument, like we do about Phil Foden at Manchester City, by playing in training with these players, you are naturally going to be improving. And actually, how much is he going to be able to show the flair and the time afforded to him in a team like Crystal Palace, who are struggling against relegation? So it's a difficult decision, but I think he'll probably stay at Chelsea. He may well prove us all wrong and go summer in January, but I imagine that Sarri's probably seen enough from him to want him in and around his squad for the upcoming games. The thing again with Chelsea is, we've seen it before with Eden Hazard, he's burnt out in seasons. Yep. and you would think that in Loftus-Cheek they haven't necessarily got a perfect replacement, but they've got somebody who's a bit of a rough diamond, who could go in there and potentially do as good a job as Hazard over probably a shorter space of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned Fulham not really in this game at all, to be honest with you. They had a small period in the second half where they possibly could have grabbed something, really just half chances, and you know, they didn't really make the keeper work for it. But ultimately, they're not the games that they need to be winning when they're bottom of the league. They've got Leicester at home this week. It's a massive game for them. Pick up a win there and, you know, it gets them up for a trip to Old Trafford at the weekend. And, you know, we'll get on to Manchester United afterwards, but they're there to be beaten at the moment as well, and Fulham could potentially go there and upset them.
That's very true. I think that Ranieri will be looking forward to facing Leicester. It's obviously a side that he's got so many great memories from, and they will be earmarking games like this against sides who aren't necessarily going to finish in the top six as, like you say, three-pointers.
League leaders, Manchester City won 3-1 at home to Bournemouth, and a little bit more of an interesting game at the Etihad this weekend. We've said time and time again, there's not really a lot that you can say about Manchester City's home games, but, you know, they won, of course. However, massive credit to Bournemouth, who were superb and ultimately really, really pushed the host. And after Manchester City took the lead, you kind of thought the inevitable was coming, but Bournemouth pushed them back, they pressed them, and they put them under some pressure. And then they've got someone in Callum Wilson who just looks like he could score against anyone and make chances out of very little as well.
It was a great header as well. I think to be able to leap that high against a relatively static back line, and the ball that came in, I think it was Simon Francis who put it in, there wasn't a huge amount of pace on it. So to be able to generate that amount of pace, head it back across the goalkeeper, and Edison's one of the best shot stoppers in the Premier League, and he got nowhere near it. So you at that point, you think, hang on, this could be game on. Manchester City might actually be in a game here. And despite the amount of changes that they made to their first team, they were actually able to go on and win. Not overly comfortably in the second half, but it's another win for them. And it's against a team who've been flying this season so far. So that will please Pep Guardiola. He didn't look happy on the bench when the equaliser went in. And he did make changes, and it just shows the strength and depth that they've got, that they were able to run out relatively easy winners in the end.
Raheem Sterling and Leroy Sane were at their best, and I think, you know, they're frightening at times now. And the way that Sterling gets at defenders, I think his first touch improves a lot, and I think he believes in himself a lot more. And you watch him sometimes, and he's almost at full sprint when he knows the ball's coming towards him, because he can just go past that defender with his first touch. And it's utter madness, really, to think of where he's come from over the last few years and the confidence that he now has. The same as Sane as well, who's just, you know, he's so quick, he's absolutely rapid. There was that one moment where he chased back a defender and he must have had, I don't know, 15, 20 yards on him and got back and defended it.
And that's Guardiola, isn't it? That's the amount of work that he does on the training pitch with these players to drill into them what their jobs are. And actually, if you do lose the ball upfield, then you do chase back and you do win it back, and if you don't win it back, then you cover the next man who goes and gets the ball. So those players are fully fully understanding of what their jobs are, and it just makes such a huge difference at a football club. When you go out, you know exactly what to expect from the game, you know exactly what your responsibility is, and that allows you to go and play the football that you know you can play. There's no confusion, there's no blurred boundaries, you know who you're picking up and when and which areas of the pitch you have to be in, and it just makes a massive difference. And it sounds so simple, but until you're actually out there against a team who you're unable to know the way that they're necessarily going to set up, you have to think about the different outcomes that could be there when you take to the pitch on a weekend. And Guardiola covers all these possibilities with his players to ensure that they are drilled to do the job that he needs them to do. And the longer this goes on, the more chance there is of them racking up more records. And, and you just wonder where that next league defeat's going to come from.
Absolutely right. And last word on Bournemouth, really. Come off the back of a tough run. Manchester United, Arsenal, and now Manchester City in the last five games. The point still stands. You know, they've been in all of those games, and some say they would have deserved at least a point, if not all three, in some of those as well. They've been brilliant all season, really, and you know, it'd be great to see them shine with a slightly easier run of fixtures. And when you see the football they play with, you know, let's face it, some fairly limited players on the pitch. They're a real credit to themselves and the manager too. And you know, I think Eddie Howe has done a fantastic job and will continue to do that. And his stock continues to rise as a result.
Yeah, and you would imagine that at some stage there will be a top four club who are going to come knocking.
Yeah, I would imagine so, and I think it's inevitable that someone higher up the league will come in for him at some point, and you know, potentially one day there's an England job waiting for him as well, but hopefully that's a long time coming with Gareth Southgate in charge.
That's it. Let's go to the South Coast because we've got a lot to talk about. Should we start with the game?
Yeah, for once, an exciting trip to Marius for a few reasons. A relatively positive result, and you know, we'll get onto it afterwards, but also the end of Marquis's tenure at the club. But I think Southampton, with a much changed team from last week out of Fulham, looked to be working for certainly the first half an hour. Obafemi, who, you know, I was saying at the game last week that he needs to come on and just offer something different, and I think he did that, certainly for the first half of this game. He came in and he got the assist for Armstrong's opener, another goal for Armstrong, who again seems to be settling into life in the Premier League now. He's obviously got a little bit of quality about him and knows where the goal is.
And the brave thing from Mark Hughes was to actually go with the same team that we lined up with against Leicester midweek. It was a better performance away at Leicester in the Carabao Cup, and ultimately I'm not convinced that we deserve to lose on penalties, but he showed confidence in that team. He wanted to put them out there because he thought they deserved a shot against Manchester United. And certainly within the first 25-30 minutes, they repaid him. I think that it's a good point on Stuart Armstrong. He looks comfortable now. And the three goals that he scored in the last two league games will give him confidence going into a hectic run of fixtures, like we say. And Obafemi looks pretty raw. I'm still not convinced that he's the finished article when it comes to Premier League football. And I would probably look to use him as an impact player at the moment, but you would argue he's probably doing more than Charlie Austin,
exactly, yeah.
Gabbiadini, and we're just hoping that Danny Ings is going to be fit at some point soon.
Where's Cedric popped up from with that free kick?
Well, I think you saw the look on Mark Hughes' face when the goal went in. He was as surprised as anyone in the stadium, and I think he was interviewed after the game and said,
probably because he thought he was keeping his job.
Yeah, he was over the moon at that stage. But no, Cedric's set piece taking in general is pretty horrendous. His crossing is poor, and when he stepped
big
up,
fun,
I was
yeah.
No, and I was begging for somebody else to take it. It just shows how far we've dropped, really, because in players like Stephen Davis, James Ward-Prowse, Ricky Lambert, Matt Letizier, we've always had players in that team who've been good at taking set pieces, and it just worries me that we've got a right back now who's first choice in a team of Premier League footballers. But you have to give him credit. It was a great finish. I don't think De Gea could do anything about it, and Manchester United at that point looked like they were there for the taking.
Well, that's it, but it didn't last, did it? And you know, you worry when Manchester United scored the two goals before half time that it had that familiar feeling about it. It was going to go on to be a bit of a rout for them. They were going to get the wind in their sails, and it, you know, it didn't happen. Again, you look at someone like Lukaku, who's got that goal, and you know, he's against a relatively fragile defence, and there's something inherently wrong with that team to not go on and try and win that game, and or certainly not go on and win the game.
I thought Marcus Rashford was brilliant in that first half, and I think that was the problem. The pace that he was able to offer just stretch those defenders, and I think out of the three of them, Jack Stevens has got a little bit of pace, Maya Yoshida's got a decent amount, but Yannick Vestergaard has got the turning circle of an Arctic lorry. And you saw for I think both goals, he was woefully out of position. He was chasing Lukaku, and I think he let him get too far ahead of him. Positionally, he was unaware. And I think at that point, especially when that goal goes in, they've got the confidence. The flick from Herrera for the second is a well-taken goal. And every Southampton fan in the stadium expected us to go on and lose that game in the second half. We were able to show a decent amount of steel. The defensive performance in the second half was good. They didn't really create a huge amount. They had a couple of free kicks towards the end. But I think that really on balance, if one team was going to win it in the second half, you would have thought it would have been Southampton with the chances that they created.
Yeah, and you know, Manchester United another day, or against another team, could have been comfortably beaten, really. And they welcome a buoyant Arsenal to Old Trafford this week, and this could be an absolute bloodbath. Mourinho is surely under a severe amount of pressure now, and it's just simply not good enough. But speaking of pressure, Mark Hughes has finally gone after 3 wins in 22 games, was it?
Yeah, I think it was about that. And I just look at his record over the course of this season, and it no other team in the Premier League has won less games. He's got a win percentage of about 18% in his time at Southampton, which if you consider you're going to win less than 1 in 5, then you're going to get relegated. And that's the form of a club who were only really going one way. So it was definitely the time to act. I think they probably have been working behind the scenes since the Fulham game. That was probably the straw that broke the camel's back as far as his future was concerned. And it can only be a positive that he's been moved on. The next appointment is absolutely crucial, and at the moment it looks like Southampton are going back to what they were good at when they brought in the likes of Mauricio Pochettino and Ronald Koeman. The appointment of Ralph Hasenhüttl, which directly translates as Ralph Rabbit Hutch, could be exactly what Southampton need. I'm just a little bit cautious at the moment until it's announced, because you look at what we've done in the past with transfer targets. We've normally leaked names to the press to try and make people's minds up, and it's backfired, and they've ended up going elsewhere. So until that's over the line, I'll not be too optimistic. But it could herald the dawn of a new era at Southampton, and hopefully bring some of the crowds back, because to not sell out a home game against Manchester United just kind of shows how disinterested fans of the club are at the moment. And we do have to remain slightly conservative over this. You look at what happened at Aston Villa. Remy Gard was heralded as an up-and-coming European coach and somebody that would take Villa away from the relegation zone. But
it was,
and I don't think that you would necessarily blame Remy Gard too much for that, because no. the fabric of the club at that time was only going in one direction, and that's the worry from a Southampton point of view. Is actually, is the culture at the club going to be easy enough to turn around, and is this man going to be the right man to do so? I think that we've tried everything that we could do on a domestic front, and I just hope that Mark Hughes doesn't get any more jobs at the top level, because he will eventually take a team down into the Championship.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I heard that David Moyes was in Nando's down at the Quay last night. Just saying.
If David Moyes takes over, I will be leaving the podcast and not going to St Mary's or any away games until that man is out of the club.
And who could blame you? That was all for part one. Join us after this break, where we are taking a trip to the Championship.
But I'll tell you, you can tell him now if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Welcome back to part two of this week's Sweeper podcast, and we are taking that trip to the Championship, and not a huge amount of movement this weekend. Results didn't do a huge amount to the table, but Norwich City still sit at the top of the pile following a comfortable 3-1 home win against Rotherham. Leeds United are in second place following an impressive 1-0 away win at fellow Yorkshire promotion chasing rival Sheffield United. A late goal from Hernandez was the clincher there. And elsewhere in the playoffs, Nottingham Forest were the only side to win, beating bottom side Ipswich Town 2-0 at City Ground. West Brom drew with Brentford on Monday following an injury time equaliser from the Bees. And finally, Middlesbrough fell 3-0 to a home defeat by Aston Villa.
I can't believe that you saved that until the end of the first paragraph and not just
building it up.
Bowled straight in there with it.
Just building it up. And what a performance from Villa. Better side throughout. Clinical. El Ghazi and Bolasie tore Borough to pieces down the flanks. John McGinney-Ester and Conor Hourihan were solid in the middle of the park. And Tammy Abraham picked up his sixth goal in three games, following one of the games of the season last week, which obviously we haven't spoken about, but a 5-5 draw at home to Nottingham Forest.
And I was going to say to you, actually, my worry with Villa this season would be that as great as you look going forward, defensively, you haven't looked fantastic, and that was highlighted in the game against Birmingham and then conceding 5 in the next game. 7 goals at home in 2 games is poor. But you've gone to Middlesbrough, who are probably one of the most defensively sound teams in the league, beaten them comfortably and kept a clean sheet, which will be probably more pleasing than all of the goals that you've scored in the last week for Dean Smith.
And we've also brought in some cover at the back as well. I don't know whether you saw this, but James Collins, Big Ginge, has come back to the club for 5 weeks until we sign Gary Cahill in January.
If you sign Gary Cahill in January, I will give you £6.
I'll take your £6. Just like Villa take they take 10 points out of 12 against Derby, Birmingham, Forest and Middlesbrough, which is absolutely fantastic, and I don't think it gets any easier either with West Brom at the Hawthorns, Stoke and Leeds at home this side of Christmas, and you know the form side in the division. It's going to be interesting to see where we are after the festive period. Meanwhile, down at the bottom there, you've got Millwall, Bolton and Reading, who all recorded draws, the latter scoring a late goal to peg Stoke City back, and Hull City lifted themselves a couple of points away from the drop zone with an impressive 3-2 win away at QPR. The fixtures are coming in thick and fast now, and we've now got the FA Cup to contend with too, as we've now reached the third round. But we had to get the second out of the way first, and we were at the final game of the round on Monday night when we visited Guiseley again for their tie with Joey Barton's Fleetwood Town.
And we had a great time, didn't we?
We did.
It was
for much of it, we had a great time.
Yeah, I was going to say it was very much a game of two halves, this one. The first half, very exciting, packed full of action, 3 goals. Second half, absolutely dreadful.
Awful. Absolutely awful, you're right. It was it was with both sides knowing that qualification meant a home tie against AFC Wimbledon as well, which for Guiseley would have been a huge pull again on the TV last night as well. And it was just, it was a great atmosphere building up to it, wasn't it? And they had to get past the Cod Army first, and they didn't make it easy for themselves, going 2-0 down in a mad 5 minutes. But that 5 minutes also meant that they got back into the game as well with a wonderful goal after pretty much gifting 2 goals to Fleetwood Town, and it was very much game on then, wasn't it?
It was, and it was a finish that you wouldn't necessarily associate with somebody who plays at that level. It was a Premier League finish, and to score the goals that Guiseley have scored in the FA Cup this season, they deserve a huge amount of credit, and hopefully they can take confidence from last night's performance into the league where they are struggling.
Yes, and you know, the crowd were going wild on literally a freezing night in West Yorkshire, and after that, the only thing warming us up was the half-time Bovril and the kind of wariness around us as well with the Fleetwood fans who descended into our area for the second half. It was getting quite lively in front of us, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yeah. There was a lot of, I say a lot of, there was about 15 Fleetwood fans bouncing around making huge amounts of noise, and they provided some entertainment, didn't they?
They did.
The pre-game entertainment, however, and I don't know if people have seen this on our Instagram page, but I don't think that anything typifies the FA Cup more than dressing your dog up as a lion.
A huge dog as well. This dog, it could have been a lion. Like, I looked at that fake mane that he had on and I thought, someone's brought a lion to the game. But it wasn't a lion, it was a dog. And it was a dog that I could genuinely get on and ride as well. And, you know, if they'd have won, I'd have thought about it. I'd have been tempted to jump on.
You're going to have to carry on, Mitch. I don't know what to say to that.
I'd have got right on it. The third round draw, as we said, was made just before kick-off. It's thrown up a few ties worth looking out for. Non-league Solihull Moors or Blackpool will host 13 times holders Arsenal. National League Southport will host Tottenham if they can get past League 2 Tranmere. And in the Battle of the Welsh Sides and the replay, Newport or Wrexham will host Leicester City. And finally, Woking host Watford in a London border derby.
Indeed, and from the FA Cup, we're going to take a little flight, a few hours down to sunny Portugal, and we're going to give you an update on our European team this season, Sporting Lisbon. Now, Sporting didn't play until last night, and they were away at bottom of the league, Rio Ave, at the appropriately named Estádio do Rio Ave. Just over 6,000 fans were there to see Sporting ease to a 3-1 victory, and that took them back to second in the league, just 2 points behind current leaders Porto. The first goal was scored by Bruno Fernandes on 8 minutes. Some lovely interplay between him and former Premier League favourite Nani saw Sporting open the scoring in a dominant first half. They did, however, concede an equaliser on 11 minutes when João Schmidt, and he's got the most Portuguese-German name I've ever heard, he scored directly from a free kick and equalised for Rio Ave. Sporting goalkeeper Renan Ribeiro beaten at his near post, and it was a rather speculative effort. Sporting, however, did not let them bother them, did not let that bother them, and 10 minutes later went back into the lead with a goal from the bad man himself, Bas Dost, to continue his frankly ridiculous scoring record for Sporting. A well-placed downward header across the Rio Ave keeper made it 2-1, and they were comfortable at half-time. The second half was one-way traffic, and Sporting had another Bas Dost goal disallowed before extending their lead in the 72nd minute following an unbelievable strike from Yovan Cabral. Think Andros Townsend's goal at the weekend, and it was pretty much a carbon copy.
An absolute ping, for sure.
It was. This away win followed a 6-1 away victory last Thursday at Carabag, which sealed Sporting's progress into the next round of the Europa League with one game to spare, and their next league game is at home this Sunday against struggling Desportivo Aves, who are only 1 point above the relegation zone in the Portuguese Primeira Liga. I'm going to give you a fact every week about Sporting, Mitch.
Bring it on.
This week's fact is about their main rivals, and they have this rivalry with Benfica. You've probably heard of the Eternal Derby, which is obviously played annually, and this rivalry originated in 1907 when 8 Benfica players left Benfica to join Sporting because they had better training conditions.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Imagine that in this day and age. I'm off because their facilities are better.
It's
got better showers.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, some Man United players seeing what's going on at the Etihad and thinking, yeah, I wouldn't mind a bit of that.
I mean, you wouldn't blame them, would you, to be fair?
No, you're right. We've got one more thing to cover before we get back to the Premier League, and that is Fantasy Premier League and the Sweeper Podcast Liga.
We have indeed. And November Manager of the Month is Oluwatobi Johnson. Another fantastic name there to join the Fantasy Premier League Manager of the Month Sweeper Podcast Liga ranks.
And yeah, congratulations, Oluwatobi. 256 points.
Wowzers.
Was the winning total, and he won it by 1 point from the Sweeper Podcast's very own co-host,
Mitchell Willis.
Not this month. I managed to cut the overall leader, Mitchell Willis's lead at the top, to 16 points. And in third place for November was Matthew Prince, who was only 4 points behind Oluwatobi. The top three spots in the Liga are currently made up of Ampadubit Society, De433, and
it's got to be Oystein Bang's team.
It is Oystein's Lag, managed by previous Manager of the Month candidate Oystein Bang. And December's a massive month for Fantasy Premier League, isn't it?
It is a huge month. It's the month where people switch off. It's the month where if you're up there, you need to be right on it. Get your transfers in, look out for the squad rotation, and if you've not used it, get your wild card in already.
It expires at the end of December before the second one is up for grabs.
It does, so yeah. Don't tell them. Don't tell them everything. Don't give them all the tips.
I've let the cat out of the bag now. That's the only reason that we're top, because people didn't know about the chips. Keep it with the Sweeper Podcast for another Fantasy Premier League update next month.
And a very quick word, actually. Luka Modric won the Ballon d'Or. Generally not overly fussed about individual prizes in football, but, you know, this one more so than any, really. But when you see that Messi and Ronaldo have dominated this since 2007, to see someone like Luka Modric come in and win it is fantastic. We saw what he did in the summer with Croatia, guided his team to a World Cup final, won the Champions League for a third successive time, and generally is an unsung hero as well, despite having the immense talent and ability that he does have. So to see him put on the top pedestal, on the top table, is fantastic to see. And Ronaldo did finish second, whilst Frenchman Griezmann and Mbappe were third and fourth, respectively, beating Lionel Messi, who was fifth. Is this the end of the dominance, or does it spur Messi and Ronaldo on?
Lionel Messi's still the best footballer in the world, and individual prizes shouldn't need awarding to tell anyone that. It's very obvious that he's the best player in the world, and I just think the whole system's bonkers.
There was also another award. It was the inaugural Women's Award, and at least it wasn't overshadowed by anything, and that's all we can say, isn't it?
Yeah.
For crying out loud, Norway and Lyon forward Ada Hegerberg won the award as she collected it. DJ Martin Solveig, is someone in the public eye, I would imagine. I've never heard of him. Asked her if she knew how to twerk, and needless to say, it's gone down like an absolute shitstorm. And rightly so. We're celebrating the women's game more so than ever at the moment, and to get the best player out there up on stage, and then this jerk goes and spoils it all by saying something stupid like, "Can you twerk?" What a tosser.
Indeed, and that's it for this part of the Sweeper Podcast. Join us after this break, where we're going up north.
Should have gone to Specsavers, Charlie, because I tell you what, he's not offside. Well, he's absolutely bang in line, not offside.
Well, maybe you should go also then, Jeff, because you couldn't see driving home the other night because you don't even wear your glasses in TV in case you get slagged off. So you just stick to Specsavers and I'll do the game.
Welcome back to the third part of this week's Sweeper Podcast, and it's time to go north, the northeast to be precise, and Newcastle, where the wheels came off and they lost 3-0 to West Ham.
On the back of a three-game winning streak, at home with an expectant St James's Park crowd, absolutely crumbled. You're right, West Ham rode their luck at times, but ultimately, a few bodies on the line, good performance from Fabianski was enough to let the attackers shine.
It was, and they hit Newcastle on the break, didn't they? Yeah. Their pace going forward is frightening at times, and I thought that with Hernandez, Arnautovic, and
Felipe Anderson.
Yeah, no, I know his name. I was just trying to avoid the fact that I backed him as the biggest
flop of the season.
Yeah, they did very well, and they just looked like a team who, when you consider how poor they were at the start of the season, the confidence that Pellegrini has allowed that side to flourish under is great. And I think that West Ham fans would probably just look for a comfortable mid-table finish this season, and they'll be very happy picking up 3-0 away wins at places like Newcastle, like you say, especially given their recent form.
And I was left dreaming of what could have been, with Robert Snodgrass delivering sumptuous balls into that Newcastle box as well. And you know, with West Ham, a win for either lifted them 3 points clear of the other. And when you look at the table now, West Ham have kind of pulled themselves away, and it's Newcastle who find themselves just 3 points above the drop zone. It shows that that's all it needs, a few results against you and, you know, below you, and a loss to someone stretching that gap between you, and you're right back in it as well.
Yeah, and I think that Newcastle will be all right. Defensively this weekend, they were a shambles, and you look at the way that they've built on performances in recent weeks, it's been generally decent defensive performances, and this just kind of went out the window on Saturday. So Rafa just needs to get them to regroup, and I still think that they'll probably have enough quality. It's interesting to hear Mike Ashley come out yesterday and say that he's planning on selling Newcastle by January, and that these talks are already sort of at a very advanced stage.
Was this like a recorded message that he just chucks out every December?
Every year, yeah. Basically, I'm not going to spend any money because I'm trying to sell the club. But no, it looks as though it may happen this time. It's unclear whether it will just be another red herring and Ashley will continue to use Newcastle as a marketing ploy for Sports Direct and his other brands. But hopefully, it's the dawn of something for Newcastle fans. And if they can tie Rafa down to a decent contract alongside new owners, then you never know, they could really push on and finish sort of top 10 this season.
And speaking of shambolic circumstances, Burnley are absolutely woeful at the moment. Crystal Palace beat them 2-0 this weekend, and to be fair to Palace, they're absolutely rampant, and really, they probably should have won by more, possibly even 4 or 5. Zaha was in imperious form, tangling up many a Burnley defender. Got Max Meyer, who showed real moments of quality in class two, and you know, they look solid against a very lacklustre Burnley attack as well. They've got two fullbacks who push as far up the pitch as anyone in Wan-Bissaka and Van Aanholt, and if they could just get that striker in there that they're desperate for, they could, you know, just fill the box with balls constantly and get something out of games, and they're just struggling to do that. But this weekend, it was a difficult proposition for Burnley.
It was, and you then look at Andros Townsend, who's probably in the best form he's been in for a few seasons,
yeah,
now.
Absolutely.
I think his goal was fantastic, and it typified what he's all about, cutting inside, curling the ball around the goalkeeper, and Joe Hart was nowhere near, and you saw the relief pour out of him. It's been a long time coming to score a goal from open play at home for Crystal Palace, and to get two in the same game will really have pleased Roy Hodgson. They need to build on this now. You still worry for them because they, like you say, they haven't got that striker. In Max Meyer, I think a lot of people thought that he would score more goals and certainly play more of a part for Crystal Palace, but he's just not been able to so far this season. And you would hope that between him, Zaha and Townsend, they could have something to build on going forward, because it doesn't look like they're going to spend a huge amount of money in January.
Burnley, on the other hand, are in real trouble. They're no attempts on target, conceded 29 efforts on their own goal. Joe Hart, again, a decent enough game, but you'd surely expect any keeper in the Premier League to look good if they're facing that many shots. And they've not won an away game in 22 efforts now. And since winning five in a row last year, they've won just two games. And yeah, it's a worrying one, really. You know, Mark Hughes had a similar record at Southampton and he lost his job.
I think the issue, though, is by bringing anyone into Burnley, they've got to change the whole ethos of the club, because Sean Dyche has been there for that long. The players know exactly what he wants. The club is set up to achieve in the manner that he's set out. And I think if you bring in a new manager, you would have to seriously look at the playing squad, because he's generally able to get a huge amount out of those players. You would argue that they massively overperformed last season and they're probably performing about right to the standard of the players that they've got in that team. And if they're able to survive relegation this season, then he would have done a brilliant job over again.
Speaking of survival, Cardiff City, a 2-1 win against Wolves, and you know, all the way back to Friday night now, and it was the visitors, Wolves, who took the lead and Matt Doherty scored. But from there, Cardiff very much got themselves back into the game. It's scruffy, as you'd expect, but very effective as well. Several chances in and around the box throughout the first half, and a second half strike from Aaron Gunnarsson that got the equaliser, but there was nothing scruffy about the winner, was there?
No, Junior Hoylett is somebody who has threatened to be a very, very good footballer for a long, long time now, and I think that in his early days with Blackburn, it looked as though he may push on, and then he ended up at QPR and probably lost his way a little bit, and now under Neil Warnock, he's had a new lease of life, and what a fantastic finish.
How old is he?
Probably not that old, you know.
Senior Hoylett.
Yeah.
Just go with that now. He's got, I reckon he's at least 45 now. But, you know, for me, there was no doubt that Cardiff were going to get something out of this game. They'll have been bang up for it against an out-of-sort Wolves. Under the lights, Neil Warnock's birthday weekend. Just, it was set up for a win, and a win that moved them out of the bottom three. Can they do it?
I don't think they will. I think that they'll still come up short, and it will be a great season. I don't think they'll get cut adrift as a lot of people thought they would do at the start of the season, but with the quality that they've got in their squad at the moment, my worry would be that they haven't got somebody who's going to get them probably 15 goals that is what you're going to need to probably stay in the Premier League. I think we need to have a little chat about Wolves, because they are out of sorts, and you saw this as an opportunity for them to get back on track, but you look at the table now, they only really just hover above the chasing pack, and they have as bad a record as anyone in the last five. They've got Chelsea coming up, and then they've got a big weekend game away at Newcastle, and you would have thought that Rafa will have his team fired up given what happened against West Ham on Saturday. So it doesn't look to be getting any easier for Nuno Espirito Santo and the set of players that we were all purring over for the first few weeks of the season.
Yeah, you're right. They probably just need a win or two just to get them back up there a little bit more and get them running again. But yeah, it's worrying times for them, because they have struggled to change too much so far this season, and we thought that was such a positive in the first kind of eight or nine games, and it's now looking to be a little bit of a negative.
And worrying times for Huddersfield Town, who had probably been the informed team in the bottom half of the Premier League over the last few weeks, but they came unstuck at home to Brighton, going down 2-1, and it couldn't have been a better start for Huddersfield, really, and they would have probably targeted this game as must-win, and they got a goal in the first minute from our mate Zanka, but the assist just came from a bizarre attempted clearance. Well, I don't really know what Bruno was doing, really. He could have probably brought it down and then just knocked it away down the line, but he just swung a boot at it and just put his whole backline under immense pressure, and it was a decent header, to be fair, and from there you expected Huddersfield to press on, but it just didn't happen, did it?
No, and you know, it's fairly even, and I think there's probably a game-changing moment when Munoz was contentiously shown a red card for a over-the-top-of-the-ball challenge. Red for you?
No, I don't think it is. I think that there has to be intent there. I don't think that by dangling your leg in the way that he did that you should be sent off. There was minimal contact. It looked as though he tried to take his foot away, but as with any refereeing decision, the difficulty is you see it at real time and it probably looks a lot worse. The fact that Michael Oliver was stood behind him as well, he was unlikely to be able to see any real movement and intent. If you side on, it's probably easier to understand what happened, and I would be pleasantly surprised if that was rescinded, because I don't think that there was any malice in it. You saw from his reaction afterwards that he didn't mean to hurt the Brighton player, and it's a shame that the game got turned on its head in an incident that didn't really warrant that much controversy.
No, and then Brighton equalised the last action of the half. It knocks the wind out of Huddersfield's sails, and then from there, both sides have chances. Second half, the referee possibly gets a couple of decisions wrong. That changes the game on another day, but the winner for Brighton is poor from a Huddersfield point of view. The ball comes in, it's too easy for Andone, and Wagner will be disappointed with the nature of the goals conceded. You can't help think that he's possibly gone with the old criticism of the referee to hide that as well.
I think when you've got a game coming up this week, I think they're away at Bournemouth, you look at that and it's a chance for them to try and get back on track. Bournemouth have been struggling of late, so straight away you will deflect the pressure from your players, and he wants to keep them on that confident run, and I don't think they'll be too disheartened by this. But the only danger, if Steve Mounier doesn't end up getting that ban overturned, is that they could potentially be losing their biggest goal threat for three games going into the busiest part of the season.
And you've got Chris Hughton on the other end, who'll be delighted. A hard-fought win. Glenn Murray rested on the bench. The win moves them up to 11th with Liverpool up next, and they love getting the big teams down to the Amex, don't they?
They do indeed. Talking of teams that love getting big teams at their home ground, we've got to go to the King Power, where Leicester were 2-0 victors over a relatively poor Watford side.
Is this the most mid-table clash going?
I think so. I think you look at these two squads and they're not going to be embroiled in a relegation battle. You would be surprised if either of them made the top six or seven. And for that reason, you would be targeting the cups as a Leicester or Watford fan. And it looks as though Watford have probably settled down a bit. They had that early season form where they were flying and then they lost a few on the bounce. And I think that Javi Gracia would have looked for more from his team in this game against a Leicester side who've been okay of late, who've obviously gone through a lot of adversity themselves for off-the-pitch reasons. And Claude Puel will be over the moon to have Jamie Vardy back in the team from the start, and also a great finish from James Maddison.
Absolutely. James Maddison, who Claude Puel was purring about, comparing him to Glenn Hoddle. Now, I wasn't fortunate enough to see that much of Glenn Hoddle, but what I have seen of him, he was very good. And what I hear of him is very good as well. I think Puel is pulling everyone's legs here. He's all right, Maddison. He's good. Shown he's more than capable of stepping up. But there's no way he can slot in at sweeper for a top European side like Glenn.
Just before we move on from this game, Claude Puel said that Nathan Redmond could be the next Thierry Henry when he came to Southampton. So I think that probably tells you that he's a little bit off in the comparison game.
Claude Puel is an absolute idiot then. If that's
looks like
case.
Ben Stiller though, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does look like Ben Stiller. But, you know, as you say, Leicester, they seem much more incisive. They look to be finding a decent bit of form as well, and you know, these home games, they'll be expecting to win every one of them. They'll be looking to challenge the teams above them as well. And Watford, again, as you say, not great over the last few games. They've only won twice in the last 10. But I can almost guarantee they'll both be next to each other in the final standings.
And that's it. We've done the Premier League. We've done the FA Cup. We've done the Championship. We've done the Portuguese Premier League. There's only one thing left, and that's the quiz. Come again. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Sweeper podcast, and it's almost time for the quiz. But before then, Mitch is going to let you know how you can get in contact with us.
You can get us on Twitter at The Sweeper Pod, Instagram, Facebook, search The Sweeper Podcast, and email us at thesweeperpodcast@gmail.com. And whilst you are at it on the correspondence, we would like you to be subscribing, rating and reviewing on iTunes. 5-star reviews and ratings would be much appreciated. Make the reviews funny as well. Put some random football knowledge in there. Old school knowledge is always welcome.
It is indeed. Yeah, 90s. Like yeah, 90s references and comparisons are very much appreciated. And let us know how you get on with a quiz each week. Let us know what your score out of 5 was. Would you be miles ahead on the Sweeper Podcast head-to-head leaderboard? Or are Mitch and I in a league of our own when it comes to football knowledge?
I would say you'll probably do a better job than I've been doing this season, because you are currently 5 points ahead.
Big, big period coming up, though.
It is a huge period coming up. And still a long way left this season to go as well. So hopefully I can pull my finger out my arse and sort myself out.
Oh, my God. Right, let's get on to this week's quiz, Mitch. So what's my first question?
Your first question is M for manager. Who's the first manager to field a starting 11 without a British player in the Premier League?
I'm going to go for Claudio Ranieri.
Is incorrect.
Was it Chelsea, though?
It was Chelsea.
I think it was against Southampton.
It was a long time before then. It could have been. It was Gianluca Vialli in 1999 on Boxing Day. Because all the English lads were hanging.
Maybe so. I've got a feeling it could have been against Southampton, so I probably should have realised that it was a little bit further back. But yeah,
quite possibly. And speaking of Italian stallions, I is for Italian. Who is the only Italian player to win the Premier League?
What a question
that
is.
Stunned silence.
Yeah. Mario Balotelli.
Correct. I was hoping it would just trick
it
you.
It did completely throw me there, because I nearly just shouted Gianfranco Zola out as well.
But, no, Mario Balotelli famously involved in a Premier League win as well.
Bonkers, isn't it? Such a mad stat when you consider that we've had some really great Italian players in the Premier League, but yeah, only him who's not contributed a huge amount other than that assist for Sergio in the last minute.
Absolutely. We'll stick on the Mediterranean theme with another. S is for second top scorer. Who is the second top scorer in the Premier League from Italy? A quiz favourite. Just 7 goals behind number one.
Difficult.
It's a toughie. I'm not going to give it you, am I?
No. I need you to fill for a bit while I have a little think.
So we've had a number of Italians in the Premier League, and we've had quite a few strikers as well. I'll give you a clue. It's not Casiraghi, who had a fairly short stint with Chelsea back in the day. It's not Benito Carboni either, who was a hero for Villa. Scored one of the greatest goals in the FA Cup against Leeds.
Was it Bradford as well?
He did go to Bradford and Sheffield Wednesday too.
I'm going to go for Gianfranco Zola.
Is correct. 59 goals behind.
Don't know.
Paolo Di Canio.
Really?
Yeah, on 66.
He was a horrible man.
He was, but very talented. Very good footballer to watch.
He was indeed.
G for question four is for Golden Boot. In the 97-98 season, 3 players shared the Golden Boot in the Premier League. Dion Dublin and Michael Owen. However, who's the third between Chris Sutton and Dennis Bergkamp?
Chris Sutton.
Correct. Straight in there. Any particular reason? Or are you just going ballsy?
No, I've just I've heard that Chris Sutton won the Golden Boot before, and I don't think it was when he was at Blackburn. So that was... Was he at Norwich at the time?
No, it was after then.
Oh, so he was at Blackburn.
I think it might have been at Chelsea.
I was thinking it was not the season when they won the Premier League.
They only scored 18 goals each, though.
Yeah.
Same a lot, does it really?
Madness.
Final question. I'm worried now. I'm worried that you're going to get 4 out of 5. F is for Faustino Asprilla, who famously played for Newcastle United. But which club did he sign from and return to following his stint in the North East?
I've got no idea, so I think you're pretty safe on this one.
Has been said before.
I remember he flew in, didn't he? And it was snowing when he got off the plane, and it's possibly the first time he'd ever seen snow or something
It was the first time he saw snow in this country.
But I've got no idea whether he came from a European club or whether it was a South American club. So I'm just going to have a guess. I'm going to go for River Plate.
Is incorrect. It was, in fact, Parma in Italy. We had a very successful period with them.
Absolutely. Well, I'll take 3.
You'll definitely take 3.
Every time. What's the scores on the doors now?
So you're 8 ahead. I think it is 18-10, which is unbelievably bad.
You've got a game in hand.
Yeah, I think I average less than a point a game, and I think you're on about 1.3 a game.
If there are any mathematicians out there who want to get in touch and work out what our current average scores are for the quiz, then let us know. We wouldn't mind getting a little name for the quiz either, would we?
No.
If anyone's got any witty suggestions, that would be much appreciated.
It would be much appreciated. But that's all for today. Let's wrap it up, because it's been brilliant. We've had a lot to talk about. It's been a bumper edition, hasn't it?
It has indeed. That's all from us this week. We look forward to discussing the midweek round of Premier League games and a Premier League and Championship roundup next weekend.
Goodbye.
Up the hustle, Hutch.